Not all meals are created equal. For instance, breakfast has the spicy egg McMuffin for a limited time, and lunch doesn't. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Joseph Sternberg, member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal. He writes political economics. He's based in London. He's also the author of, most recently, The Theft of a Decade, How the Baby Boomers Stole the Millennials' Economic Future. I turn now to the economic future at hand, a headline in the Wall Street Journal in these last days. Fed officials weigh ending asset purchases by mid-2022. Subhead, reducing bond buying sooner could provide more flexibility to raise interest rates if inflation stays high and unemployment falls rapidly. Joe, a very good evening to you in London. Your most recent column looking at the large spending proposed by the Biden administration. Some of it is already in hand, but others of it is aspirational. Spending has often been associated with inflation, not profoundly, just sort of associated. Mostly it's understood as we don't need it because we're recovering fine. The Fed has been reluctant, over these last months, to say we're recovering fine and to say that they will not be making any changes in the near zero interest rate until 2023, somewhere in the foggy future. Now it looks like the Fed is thinking about rethinking. How do you read this most recent headline that they're looking at ending bond purchases? Does that strengthen the dollar? Does that strengthen the economy? Is this a good thing? Good evening to you, Joe.
Hey, John. Well, it's such a looking glass world that we're living in when it comes to these issues like inflation and what, officials and particularly what the Federal Reserve is going to do about it. Because the inflation is here, and yet the big news that you and I are talking about right now is the prospect that the Fed might get itself organized to do something about it next year. That's really my takeaway from some of these stories. I mean, clearly Federal Reserve officials are becoming very concerned about inflation. This is very belated on their part because the rest of us have been observing the inflation in our daily lives for a considerable amount of time now. And so I read in some of these noises that are starting to emanate from the Fed a recognition that actually the inflation is real. It is not going to be as temporary as they used to claim they thought it would be. And they're going to have to do something about it. And yet they're still stuck in this mode where they think that talking about doing something is as good as actually doing something. And so I think that what they're probably hoping is if they start signaling now that they might scale back on some of these bond purchases or quantitative easing, which remember was just supposed to be a measure for the depth of the pandemic crisis last year. They're probably hoping if they start talking about scaling some of that back, the market will respond accordingly, and that by itself will start bringing the inflation under control without them having to do it. But what this really highlights is that we're kind of stuck waiting and waiting and waiting for someone to actually do something. Well, a lot of American households are paying and paying and paying when it comes time to go to the gas pump or the grocery store.
Boston Fed President Eric Rosengren said in an interview he expected to see by the September 21-22 Fed meeting enough job growth to meet the criteria for reducing bond purchases. This suggests, Joe, that they're watching, what is this, the twin charge of the Fed, which is the interest of the inflation rate, 2% is their ambition, and the jobs rate. The jobs rate improve. We know we have many more jobs than we have workers. We know that the hiring has started again. There have been positive reports for some time. So I'm trying to read this. Is the Boston Fed president, Mr. Rosengren, telling us that they're going to slow down, to taper the bond purchases And is that going to change the market direction? Has the market already put that in the numbers, Joe?
Well, I think that certainly investors are going to have to price in some expectation about what the Fed might do and when they might do it. So I guess from that perspective, there's an element where all of this talking, or, you know, what my colleagues and I sometimes describe as open mouth operations, as opposed to the open market operations the central banks usually run, you know, that is intended to kind of smooth out whatever the market response to the eventual policy is going to be. But, you know, I think that the problem that they're kind of running into here, and you really hit the nail on the head with your discussion about the job market, because, you know, they do have this dual mandate to deliver full employment and price stability. Mm-hmm. And what we've discovered is that they don't really have a particularly good understanding about either of those things. So they've been talking about how far away America remains from full employment without really having a clear definition of what full employment means. I mean, they seem to have in mind a combination of a particular unemployment rate and a particular participation rate, the percentage of population that is in the labor force. And yet you have all of this evidence that actually there are many more jobs than there are workers who are actually prepared to take those jobs right now. I mean, by any sensible definition I can think of, that would suggest that we are at some kind of as much full employment as the central bank can deliver. And the same with inflation, where, I mean, the inflation has been here for a while. So clearly they have been failing at their price stability mandate, and yet they keep coming up with ways of defining themselves out of that problem by devising these excuses for why the inflation is not something that they should be concerned about right now. So I think that it is telling that we're reaching a point on both of these fronts where they're realizing that, you know, sort of this inventiveness needs to go in the other direction, that maybe now they need to be looking for pretexts to start tightening policy, or at least dialing back these emergency measures. But they've spent an awful long time getting to this point. While a lot of these economic measures that we are concerned about, particularly in the inflation, have been growing more serious.
Your most recent column introduces us to an unknown to me, financial repression. That's a concept invented in the 1970s, and you apply it to what we're seeing are the ambitions of Congress to spend money. What is financial repression?
Well, it's a term economists have talked about for about 50 years now to describe basically the misallocation of capital in the economy, and particularly in a way that is bad for households. So the basic concept here is that policymakers suppress the interest rates you as a household, as an individual, can earn on your savings account at the bank, or even potentially on your investments, suppress those returns, and that will make capital cheap enough that the government can send money to favor interest groups. So, I mean, if you talk about China, which is where this issue has been popping up for a long time, people will say, well, Beijing is keeping low the interest rates that Chinese households can earn on their savings account at the bank, so that then those state-owned banks can pour money into all of these inefficient state-owned enterprises. Well, guess what? We're developing a real version of that in the U.S. and other ostensibly market-developed economies, because, I mean, basically, who can remember the last time you got a interest rate on a savings account at a bank that was even 1%, right? So you are actually losing money in inflation-adjusted terms if you're a saver, and even on many government bonds, the inflation-adjusted return is negative right now. That is a losing bet. And we are doing this so that we have cheap credit available for particular kinds of borrowers, especially the large companies that can issue bonds in the marketplace, and most of all for the government, because remember, the purpose of the low interest rates now seems to be to allow the government to finance these enormous deficits so that Congress and the administration are able to funnel that money to their favored interest groups. And the key point here is that this serves as another form of tax. I mean, we're going to be paying for all of this government spending, not just in the future tax checks that we'll write to the IRS. We're paying for it right now in terms of the fact that we're constantly treading water in terms of our savings, our ability to prepare for our own financial future.
You mentioned that Elizabeth Warren is no fan of Fed Chairman Jerome Powell. I think you say she wants him replaced. Is that to advance financial repression? Is Liz Warren a repressor?
Yes. I mean, it's important to understand there are a bunch of different ways that this works. I mean, I've given the example of interest rates, but that political allocation of capital can also happen through regulation. When the Federal Reserve has come out with all of these capital regulations on banks that ostensibly are supposed to prevent another crash or panic such as we had in 2008. But don't lose sight of the fact that one of the effects of those policies is to try to encourage banks to stockpile government bonds because that is viewed as a safe asset. And so the functional effect of those policies is to drive down the interest rate that the government pays on bonds because so many banks will be buying them. And there's a regulatory angle here too when, people like Elizabeth Warren, use their position of influence within the government or within Congress, to try to lean on regulators to direct banks, or other financial institutions to send capital one place or another, try to apply the pressure directly to financial institutions, as Congress sometimes does.
You note, Joe, with very careful language, the redirection of savers' resources to favored borrowers. Is this what sometimes is called redistribution? Is that what or is that too much of a partisan word?
Oh, it absolutely is a form of redistribution. I mean, we tend to think of redistribution in terms of taking tax revenue from one individual taxpayer to give to another individual citizen in the form of social benefits or the like. But people should understand that this can also happen, in sort of a corporate level or a more macro level. And you could have this redistribution of assets from savers who are putting money into the bank or into the financial system and not getting a positive inflation-adjusted return from it. And the beneficiary of that are various borrowers, who are the people who policymakers have decided that they want to favor for whatever reason with this mix of policies. And so people should understand that redistribution is not only about you writing a check to the government so that the government can write a check to someone else. Sometimes it happens very deliberately, but without anyone having to write a check to anyone else. It's sort of this balance of where capital flows through the economy that can do the redistribution.
I'm speaking with Joseph Sternberg, a member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal. He's based in London, writes the political economics column. He's also the author most recently of The Theft of a Decade, How the Baby Boomers Stole the Millennials' Economic Future. There's news in London. It is about the markets, but it's also about Kabul when we come back. How is London explaining what is now fog of war, evacuation catastrophe, at least from the videos? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.
We all deserve some yay in our day. So say hello to Hello. Hello makes oral and personal care products that add wonder to your routine, like a toothpaste that makes brushing fun for kids. It's called Unicorn Sparkle Toothpaste. It tastes like rainbows and sunshine, works brilliantly, and it's fun. So it's pretty much magic. And for the adults, Hello Anti-Plaque and Whitening Toothpaste, which is just as good without the unicorns. Visit HelloProducts.com and let Hello add some everyday yay into your life.